This is Radio Free Aslan, broadcasting from occupied territory.
Hello again. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and I want to welcome you to another Radio Free Aslan podcast, courtesy of the Chicano Development Center. Today, we are talking to Teofilo Reyes, the director of Thai Global, an international workers organization, which, according to their literature, was founded in, quote, 1978 through the initiative of union activists from various countries. It goes on to say that today, Thai includes activists in every continent and has active groups in Bangladesh, Brazil, Germany, Mexico, Senegal, South Africa, Sri Lanka, Turkey, and the U.S. From the beginning, Thai has supported worker initiatives that see themselves as part of a broader movement for social change, committed to fight for a life without exploitation and exclusion, a life grounded in the dignity of human beings and their freedom for self-determination. Unquote. Issues surrounding the treatment and rights of workers organizing, crossing, or attempting to cross international borders in search of work and a better life for their families is especially salient today as multinational corporations move boldly to secure their right to freely transport the goods made by workers in third world countries while simultaneously denying those same workers the right of movement and organization. It's with these thoughts in mind as a framework for our conversation that we want to welcome Teofilo to the podcast and give him a minute to tell us about himself and what his role in Thai Global is.
I'm a labor activist who is part of the international coordination for Thai Global. So we have a body of coordinators from several regions around the world, from Europe, Asia, South America, North America. So I'm the coordinator, the international coordinator from the United States, really for North America, for Thai Global.
Okay, so when you say North America, what exactly does that include?
Well, in practice, it includes Mexico and the U.S. I mean, we have groups that are actively involved in both Mexico and in the United States in activities with Thai Global. I mean, we also have, you know, friends and allies in Canada and throughout Central America, but actively involved, we're mostly just in the U.S. and in Mexico.
Okay, so from the quote earlier, we can see that Thai is really a group that kind of brings like union activists from various countries together. I mean, what sort of role do you play as the international coordinator for North America? I mean, what exactly is it that Thai does?
Well, Thai seeks to promote and develop projects. Joint projects between workers, both within countries and across countries, projects that are really initiated from workers themselves, worker organizations. So as being on the coordination essentially means keeping in touch with what is happening in the other regions, helping maintain flow information, helping exchange ideas. I mean, one of the purposes of TIES is to see what is happening, sort of what initiatives or what strategies organizations or individuals have developed in different countries and try to export them, then try to socialize them across multiple regions. Essentially, you know, we see this happening in corporations where they, you know, there's a flow of information as to what management strategies are effective. So we want to counteract that by finding worker strategies that are effective and trying to spread and socialize those around the world.
Okay, so in conversations that we've had before in the past about this project, I mean, one of the things that's really come up is this whole idea of independent labor unions or independent labor movements. I mean, could you explain to us a little bit exactly what that means in the context of the United States, but also in other countries? I mean, what does it mean in Mexico to have an independent labor union?
In Mexico, what that means is that that unions need to be, really all it means is that unions need to be controlled by their members, and that is not always the case. I mean, in Mexico, there's a long tradition of unions essentially having been an arm of the of what was the ruling party pre, but once the, which was the Institutional Revolutionary Party, but once the pre lost was, you know, voted out of office, so all those unions that had been allied with the pre very, very easily allied themselves with the current government. So essentially we want we support are unions that are independent of outside bodies controlling and dictating their activities, whether that's any kind of political party of any persuasion or corporations. Another big problem in Mexico are what are called sindicatos blancos, which I guess we translate as yellow unions or corporate unions. Essentially, the companies will set up a union themselves to ensure the workforce is compliant. So, you know, unions need to represent their members, and the workers need to be able to you know, have a say in the decisions their unions make, and that's what we mean by independent unions.
Okay. So how does that translate into the work that you do here in the United States? Because, I mean, obviously the labor movement here has its own issues. And so we might not necessarily be talking about independent labor movements, but we are talking about sort of a democratization movement within unions. I mean, how do those two things relate?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, we might use different terms based on local context, but you know, when we talk about, you know, democratic labor movement in the U.S., we're referring to one that's independent of the Democratic Party, you know, that doesn't just simply act as an arm of any party, that it's not doesn't act as that is not a tool of mafia interest, as is the case at times. And so efforts to democratize unions in many cases involve, for example, kicking out mafia influences, and that's in many cases where the government has trusted unions such as the Teamsters, it was in order to do that. But essentially, the ultimate goal is the same.
And the ultimate goal is the same. And what is the ultimate goal?
Well, the workers are able to control their unions. I mean, there's a lot of mechanisms that get used that are developed in order to prevent workers from having a say in their unions. Whether it's, you know, whether it's by, you know, very cleverly controlling bylaws, or whether it's by having multiple layers of bureaucracy. There's a lot of tools that are developed to prevent workers from having a say in their unions, and that's the goal is to overcome that.
So, I mean, when we think about workers controlling their unions, I mean, what really becomes important? I mean, what are the real gains or the benefits of a worker-controlled union as opposed to a union that is, you know, officially sponsored by the state or by a corporation?
Well, I won't go to quite that extreme. Well, I guess I will maybe in making a contrast here between Mexico and the U.S. So one of the things we've seen in one of the unions that has been the fastest growing in the United States, or at least claims to be the fastest growing union, which is the Service Employees International Union, you know, we've seen that they're strategy to maintain growth has been to create these humongous locals, to create these locals that have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of members, and that effectively removes, you know, any voice that members might have in their locals. But their strategy, the union strategy along with this, is then to negotiate agreements with companies, independent really of involvement with the workforce, and they claim. The claim is that this is you know, this is more effective. This is a strategy that strategy that allows both company and the union to thrive. But in practice, the union ends up instituting practices that are detrimental to the workers themselves. And I think it's very similar to what happens with company unions in Mexico, where, for example, in the maquiladoras, which are the export processing plant, when they open up, they'll often sign a contract with a union prior to any workers having been hired, and then after that, the unions really have no more involvement in the company, and many times the workers don't even know what the content of their contract is or what the terms are. And when they try to, if they try to form their own union or try to develop their own voice in their workplace, so that's stymied because there's already these legal structures in place. And so I think that's very similar to what we see as sort of one of the main corporate strategies of union organizing in the United States.
Wow, that's incredible. Is that even legal to do?
Yeah, I believe it. I guess I'm not an expert on labor law.
Right.
But I believe it is legal. But I mean, there's, but that's not. I mean, legality or illegality is not. Is not really the point. I mean, there's tremendous, there's great labor law in Mexico is great. I mean, it gives workers a tremendous number of rights, but it's never applied. And in many cases, we see the same thing here in the U.S. You know, where even though workers are guaranteed union elections, if they all gather to, if they all sign a petition and to the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, in practice, it's, you know, those elections get delayed oftentimes by for years and years and years, and when elections finally happen, many of the workers that first signed those petitions have been fired and are no longer there. So, I mean, laws. I don't think the labor law is really the issue. The issue is how are workers able to create power on the job so that they don't have to worry about what the exact content of the law is.
Okay. So, all right. So what we're seeing recently within the last couple of years is a lot of activity around organizing, or this big push to organize with SEIU and a number of other labor organizations splitting off from the AFL-CIO and saying that they're going to go out on their own and that they're going to, you know, organize millions of workers. I mean, what's really going on with that? I mean, from your perspective as a person who is looking at labor movements across the world and is working with people across the world in different types of labor movements and worker organizations, I mean, how do you see this this push or this effort towards or this this proclaimed push or effort towards worker organizing here in the United States?
You know, I think that there's definitely an interest, right, in organizing, but in practice, the practice just doesn't measure up. And most of these, you know, the initiatives such as the Change to Win, where several unions split away from the AFL-CIO, I mean, that has really been a failure, and that they haven't really achieved any of the goals that they claimed to, you know, purported to set for themselves. And many of the unions in Change to Win have or are slowly returning back to the AFL. They're just trying not to make a big splash about it. I mean, the big problem is the perspective towards organizing, and again, this question of who ultimately controls unions, and what's happened is that what I think's happened anyways since the 70s, probably since the 60s, as unions became complacent, you know, as they became successful, they became complacent, and you know, the union leadership became highly depoliticized, and in many cases, I mean, what's happened in unions happened across the country, right? There's really no class consciousness, so a lot of union leaders sort of see themselves, you know, as management. So it's really hard to really develop effective organizing strategies with those perspectives. I mean, even where unions have been effective, have effective organizing campaigns, it's the only goal is to gain numbers. And so, you know, you have these hot shop tactics where you rush in, you sign workers, get workers to sign union cards. And if you're not successful within a very short time, then the union will disappear, and the workers are left there, you know, then to deal with management if the union drive is not successful immediately. And so you don't have a class consciousness where you see in any type of organizing as a strategy to develop workplace power. You just see it as a strategy to increase your numbers for your lobbying, for whatever, you know, parochial interest that your union has.
I was going to say, do you see that sort of class consciousness? Is it more prevalent in other countries, other places around the world than it is here in the United States?
Yeah, it's absolutely more prevalent in other countries. However, you know, there's a similar phenomenon that is happening or has happened in other countries. But just, for example, you know, we worry so much here about union, or much of the talk here is about union density, about how union density has decreased so dramatically, such that it's, you know, we're less than 10% of the workforce is unionized, and I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but you know, just the vast majority of unionized workers are public sector workers. But you can compare it to France, for example, where you have a similar percentage of workers organized, but when there is a when there is a strike or a mass action, there is a tremendous amount of solidarity from workers across the spectrum. So you know that if there's if truck drivers in France call a strike and blockade, you know, highways, they will get a lot of support from workers, whether they're in unions or not.
Okay. I mean, we've all seen that, you know, people. I mean, what was the farmer who pulled the roof off of the McDonald's in France?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they have, I mean, very powerful, very radical, direct actions, you know, that show a lot of solidarity across society. And so, yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think that's definitely something that doesn't happen here, that there's a lack of this sort of like class consciousness. So, I mean, but when we think about that and we see the all of the things that are really kind of starting to spark off that are directed particularly towards the Chicano Mexicano community here in the United States. I mean, when we look at SEIU and some of their more prominent victories, you know, like the Justice for Janitors and some of these other things. I mean, do you think that the Latino community or the Latino population in the United States is really the future of the labor movement?
Well, it's an important part of the labor movement. I mean, I think it's, now that's, like, if you want to talk about some positive changes in the labor movement past decade, I mean, I just the change in rhetoric towards immigrants has been, and I wouldn't say towards Latinos, but specifically towards immigrants has changed dramatically, right? Whereas in the past, it would have been, where, you know, some at the local level, you might not have changed the attitude, and I think there's unions still have a lot of work to do in sort of educating a lot of the membership, but just their public support for organizing immigrant workforce has been a very important rhetorical change. And in practice, certainly, I mean, the unions that have been growing by organizing workplaces that have been, you know, that do have a large percentage of immigrant workers, you know, that's a very important component of it.
Okay. And so, I mean, lots of times we see this sort of like anti-immigrant, you know, pro-U.S. sort of stance that people kind of blindly take. But I mean, in reality, I mean, what's the benefit of helping workers in other countries organize democratic, independent labor unions? I mean, how do workers in the U.S. benefit from that?
I think there's a couple different sort of levels to that. On the one hand, it's very easy for workers to fall for blackmail or you know, these threats that companies make. Management often makes threats that they're I mean, it depends on the industry, but in light manufacturing, a lot of workplaces will have the management will post up a picture of an arrow pointing down towards Mexico, for example, highlighting that if workers don't you know, increase productivity and you know, work harder, that their jobs will get shipped to Mexico. In fact, I mean, so on one level, it's very clear that workers are being pitted against each other on this sort of in this sort of emotional framework, and it becomes very easy to demonize people in other places as stealing your job, and obviously the understanding is that your job is getting stolen by someone in Mexico or in China because their wages are so low, and so. I mean, if that's true, what's the response? Is the response to get mad at workers in Mexico and in China and see them as your enemy, or is the response to see them as an ally and work together to improve conditions so that you know, there isn't this race to the bottom? Ultimately, management uses this type of strategy to lower working conditions, to lower wages, and they don't just use it here in Mexico. That, you know, workers there have the same threats about jobs being shifted to China or Vietnam or somewhere else. So you see a lot of, in northern Mexico, we've seen demonization of workers in China, same way you see that about workers in Mexico here. And so, you know, what is the more effective strategy for dealing with that problem? Now, in reality, it's not as simple as that because of company management. You know, a lot of times that's really just an idle threat. But the fact that we see production increasing in these other regions sort of makes it seem like a real threat. And so, I mean, it seems to me clear that if you are able to improve working conditions in Mexico, for example, it makes it a lot easier to improve working conditions here as well. That being said, I don't think it's. I think it has been far too easy for management to decrease wages and decrease working conditions here in the U.S. just based on the reality that it's actually very difficult for management to ship production far away. You know, transport costs are very high, logistical costs get very high, which is why just looking at Mexico, where's all the export production for auto parts is all along northern Mexico, and then you see production of auto assembly in Mexico that occurs in central Mexico is just for the domestic market, and the only in industries such as garment, where I think the final product is really easy to package and ship, you see some production in Central America, South and Southern Mexico, and Asia, or light electronics that are easy to ship. But when it comes to bigger, once the shipping costs get really high, which happens rather quickly, you don't really have that kind of the threat that we see as being out there is actually not as real as we think it is.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I didn't really think about it in terms of shipping costs and those types of things. Till, we got a few minutes left. What I want you to do is tell us a little bit about the worker-to-worker program that Thai Global does, and why you think it's beneficial, how people can get involved in it.
We're very keen on having workers exchange directly, exchange experiences directly. That is, that's one of our missions, is to have exchange visits between workers and their organizations. And so we have partners that are in Sri Lanka and in Bangladesh, in Senegal, in Mozambique, in South Africa, in Germany, in France, in Brazil, in Mexico, and I'm sure in a few other countries that I'm missing. We have partners that we work very closely with, and we would love to have, see exchanges happen with workers here in the U.S. to exchange ideas, but also to think about ways to work together. One of the projects we're working on right now is called Vida Viva, which I guess translates as Life Alive, and it's an effort to see how working conditions impact not just your health on the job, but also your home life, your family life, your neighborhood life, and try to look at best practices. Instead of seeing a race to the bottom, we want to help promote a race to the top. And so this is a project that we're trying to push here in the U.S., where workers in the workplace get together with their coworkers to discuss how it is that their work is affecting their immediate health due to working conditions, but also how the stress, for example, affects their relationship to their children, and then share those experiences with workers in other industries in the U.S. and in other countries as well. And another project we have is called Exchange, which is a little more a traditional project in that it directly links garment workers in Asia with retail workers in Europe, so that they can support each other in their struggles to improve working conditions, and we'd like to have, we'd like to see the U.S. get more involved in that as well, and so the worker-to-worker project is an opportunity to try to connect with workers who are working in the same industry as yours or in the same company or simply to hear about what strategies unions are using in other countries to fight for their rights in the workplace.
Okay. That is all we have for now. I want to thank again Teofilo Reyes for being here today and conversating with us about worker solidarity across the globe. If you want to learn more about Thai Global, you can check out their website at www.tie-global.org. That's www.thai-global.org. You can also help to support democratic union organizing in this country and around the globe by working with the Chicano Development Center and Thai Global to bring worker delegations here to talk about their efforts to organize. You can find more information about this worker-to-worker, worker-to-student program at the chicanocenter.org, chicanocenter.org. My name is Ernesto Todd Morales, and this is another podcast of Radio Free Aslan, brought to you by the Chicano Development Center. A special thanks goes out to our producers, Louis Moreno Jr. and Roberto Reyes. Have a good day.
This monthly podcast is brought to you by the Chicano Development Center, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to education and political empowerment through grassroots coalition building. We believe in the indigenous sovereignty of the Chicano people in the United States, and that true social and political change begins with the people. Our style of low-intensity organizing endeavors to build intentional communities within greater communities. The motivating force behind low-intensity organizing is to constantly challenge the status quo as to the treatment and economic status, not only of Chicanos and other indigenous people, but of all oppressed people. At the Chicano Development Center, we believe that resistance begins with education, organization, and preparation. We believe that Raza must take action on a regular basis, not just in times of crisis.
Love the best.